We here in Iowa had one of the wettest springs on record. But with little current rainfall, the Weather Service says a flash drought is a possibility. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll talk with weather and ag experts about what the lack of rainfall might mean. Before that, we'll hear about invasive species. The emerald ash borer is in the news again. And there are new laws for boaters to help prevent invasive species in waterways. Tuesday night, a pitcher on Cuba's national baseball team defected in Des Moines. We'll also find out more about that. That's all coming up this hour. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Boy, we have a packed hour for you over the noon hour today on Iowa Public Radio. Tuesday night, a pitcher on Cuba's national baseball team defected after the team arrived in Des Moines for an exhibition game. We'll find out more about that a little bit later in the program. Also, Iowa, we just had one of the wettest springs on record, but there is little rainfall in the last few weeks, and the Weather Service is warning about a flash drought as a possibility. A flash drought, what's that? We'll find out toward the end of our hour when we talk with state climatologist Harry Hilliker. He'll also give us an update on the weather forecast for Ragbri Week, which is coming up. But first, let's talk about invasive species. The emerald ash borer is in the news again, unfortunately, and there are new laws for boaters to help prevent invasive species in waterways. Joining me to talk about those two things, Robin Prusner is a state entomologist at the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, and Robin is joining us from our Des Moines studio. Hi, Robin. Robin, are you there?
I am.
Oh, now I hear you. Very good. Thank you for coming to our studio, being on the show. Kim Bogenschutz is with us as well, the Department of Natural Resources Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator. Kim is in our AIM studio, I believe. Hello, Kim.
Hey, Ben.
Great to have you with us. Let's start off with the emerald ash borer, if we could, Robin. This week, state officials announced that this beetle that has killed millions of ash trees around the country, has been found in Burlington. Now, that's in the southeast corner of the state, about 100 miles south of the Quad Cities. This is the second confirmed infestation of emerald ash borer in the state. The other we had, I believe, last year, wasn't it, in Ala McKee County. That's in the far northwest corner of the state. The invasive insect first found there in 2010. Robin, what is the significance of this find?
The significance of the emerald ash borer jumping down to Des Moines County is that it's obviously not next to Ala McKee, so it didn't spread from Ala McKee. It more likely spread from Illinois. Because about 30 miles away in Galesburg, emerald ash borer was confirmed there last year. So we're starting to see emerald ash borer kind of attack Iowa from multiple directions.
Mm-hmm. So you were expecting, when it was discovered in Ala McKee in 2010, that it would spread from there possibly, or were you also looking across the border? Was this a surprise, I guess, is the question.
It really wasn't a surprise because of the known infestations kind of up and down that Iowa-Illinois border on the Illinois side.
Mm-hmm. So what additional actions are being taken because of this discovery?
Because of this discovery, we are now taking a look at how we are going to expand our quarantine to try and limit the movement of high-risk items like firewood. And so what we need to do is take a look at the wood products industry down in that corner of the state and figure out, do we need to just quarantine Des Moines County, or do we need to look at a larger area so that industry and citizens can continue to operate without expanding the risk of moving emerald ash borer too far?
Mm-hmm. Firewood, I get that, but what kind of wood industry is in that area?
There are sawmills down there. The wood products industry in Iowa employs over 18,000 Iowans, so it is an active component of our economy. So we need to look at the areas that the different sawmills work in, how many county lines that they cross. The reality is that the infestation's been there for a couple of years, and so they've already, everybody's already been moving ash products around, and it could have spread outside of Burlington. So we're also having to look and see if we can figure out how far out that infestation goes.
Right, because isn't the difficulty here is that you can only detect the presence of this beetle long after it's been there. Is that right?
That is correct. It usually takes 2 or more years, oftentimes 5, before we can find that infestation.
Why is that?
It's difficult. It's hard to spot. The larva, which it spends the bulk of the year as, is under the bark of trees. So you can't really take your binoculars out and look for it. You have to peel the bark off the tree. Once you do that to a tree, the tree doesn't respond well. So nobody wants to take that kind of survey action on the ash tree in their yard.
Mm-hmm. So this adult emerald ash borer comes along, transits from wherever it was to a new ash tree, and it's just looking for a place to lay its eggs?
Right. Lays its eggs on the bark. Larva hatches, burrows down, and begins feeding on what we call the plumbing or the vascular system of the tree. And in about 2 to 4 years, you can expect that tree to die then.
Mm-hmm. What's so special about an ash tree that it only does it to ash trees, right?
Correct. It's a specialist, and it only feeds on Fraxinus or ash trees. It's just how it's developed. In China, they have also seen it on walnut. Here in the United States, actually, there's a lab in Brighton, Michigan that has had longstanding research trying to see if it is going to jump species. They try and force it on other species in the laboratory. And mm-hmm. to date, it has stayed only on ash here in the United States.
How fast can it spread?
On its own wing power, it only travels 2 to 5 miles in a given year. But it travels a lot faster when you cut an infested tree up as firewood and throw it in the back of your truck and go down the interstate. Mm-hmm. And so that's the difficulty in trying to predict where this insect is going to show up next, is because of the human transport component.
So when we have an infestation out east, now coming toward our eastern border here in Iowa, what does it leave in its wake? Are all ash trees then destroyed, or what happens?
That's what we're seeing out in the areas that have been infested far longer than Iowa, is that it works its way through all of the ash trees.
Okay. So when we talk about prevention, what can be done? We want to be extra careful with firewood, especially because we're out camping. That means specifically get the firewood at the campground, buy it from a reliable source at the campground. Do not truck it in from even if you have a ton of it on your lot, right?
Correct. What we really hate to see people do is, you know, take that diseased or infested tree down and then transport that wood long distances. One of the taglines we use is buy it local, burn it local, and try not to move that firewood. We typically say keep it within your county.
Mm-hmm. Are there other ways that the emerald ash borer infestation can be battled?
You know, homeowners, if they have a particular tree that they would like to save, treatment is an option in some cases. First, I want to say that for people in that Burlington area or anywhere else in Iowa, treatments are actually too late to be applied in 2013. You actually need to do that early spring, like April, May. So if you have someone knocking on your door saying, hey, you have an ash tree in your yard and I'd like to treat it, I would politely decline them at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how do you know? Let's say our Burlington area listeners are now really worried if they haven't heard this news already. They're out in their yard looking at their ash tree. What can they see, or can they see anything, or won't they see the results of this beetle, this borer, for quite a while?
Some of the symptoms of emerald ash borer are dieback of the crown or the top of the tree. You may see a lot of sprouting down under where the damage has been incurred on the tree. If you're really good eagle-eyed, you will see D-shaped exit holes, but they're only about 1/8 of an inch wide, usually occurs on the top of the tree first. If you peel the bark back, there is serpentine or S-shaped galleries where the insect has been feeding. Sometimes the easiest thing to see is woodpecker damage. The woodpeckers can peck down, and it makes a great lunch for them. Another symptom is the vertical splits in the bark over the feeding galleries. Mm-hmm. However, all of these are symptoms of other insects or issues that trees may be having. So just because you see one or more of these symptoms on your ash tree does not necessarily mean it's emerald ash borer. There may be other issues.
It would be nice if there was another species. I don't know if we could get enough woodpeckers to do it, but another species that would eat the ash borer before it got to the rest of our ash trees.
That would be a great biological control. Yeah.
What is the future of this infestation? It sounds like we can only slow it, that we can't really stop it from spreading here. Is that true?
Right. In the mid-2000s, actually, the USDA gave up the ghost on trying to eradicate this insect. And they had over 35 attempts at eradication out in Michigan, Indiana, Ohio area, and none of them turned out to be successful long term. So our goal since then has been exactly that, slowing the spread, allowing communities and landowners time to prepare and deal with it so that they don't get kind of slammed and have to deal with a big mess all at one time.
So deal with it in terms of getting younger, different sorts of trees growing.
Right. From a city perspective, you know, there are cities that some have anywhere from 10 to over 50% of their street trees are ash trees. And so the Department of Natural Resources has a state urban forester, Emma Hannigan. She's been out working especially with communities of less than 5,000 people. The recommendations there are do a tree inventory. You know, in short, know what you've got. How many do you have? What type of condition are they in? And then what's your plan? The best thing that we would like to see cities do is, can they deal with the number of ash trees that they have on city property or city right-of-way right now? What's their long-term plan in terms of maybe taking down and replacing? Do they have some trees that they can wish to target and treat? And what resources and time commitment is it going to take on their end?
Mm-hmm. Before we move on to the water with Kim Bogenschutz, let's talk about another thing that's been bugging us, so to speak, gypsy moths, a concern in the state. Why?
The gypsy moth is a moth that's been also moving to Iowa from the east. It's actually been in the United States since the 1860s. It is different from the emerald ash borer that it is not a specialist only on one species of trees, but actually likes to eat most anything that's green. If it's a tree, it's going to eat it. And it defoliates the trees. And if a tree goes through repeated years of defoliation on top of environmental stresses like, floods and droughts, you start to see tree mortality there. In late June, we did two mating disruption treatments in eastern Iowa, one in Dubuque and one in Alameda County. And that is an effort to, again, suppress that population and keep damage to a minimum and slow that spread into Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Robin, I just did a Google image search on this, and I see, I thought it was going to be a really nice looking moth. I guess it is nice looking in its own way, but it's not colorful is what I mean. So describe it a little bit.
You're absolutely correct. The moth, the males tend to be kind of a brown, mottled, barky colored moth, nothing outstanding. The females are actually a lighter colored moth, a lot bigger bodied, and I tend to really like the female because she actually doesn't fly. She's got such a big body. If she's going to go anywhere, she walks. So on tiny insect legs, that's not very far. But the name of Gypsy, they are very adept at hitchhiking. And so, we have another human-assisted movement of an insect pest, though the males are capable of flying many, many miles.
Okay, Robin Prusner is state entomologist at the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. We might have a question for you in a minute, so please hang on in our Des Moines studio, Robin. Let's turn to Kim Bogenschutz, the DNR's Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator. It's all about invasive species this half hour. Kim, I understand that since July 1st, Iowa boaters have needed to follow new laws designed to protect the state's lakes and rivers from non-native aquatic species. What are the new laws?
Well, the new laws require boaters to remove everything from their boats and equipment before leaving a water body. So all vegetation, all algae, all aquatic invasive species as well. They also have to drain all of the water from their live wells, from bait, from their bilge wells, and they have to keep the plugs of those water containers out while they're transporting or being transported down the road.
Mm-hmm. So what are we protecting from with those actions?
Well, we are protecting from the spread of Eurasian water milfoil and brittle naiad, which are two plants that we have throughout Iowa, and particularly zebra mussels. When zebra mussels are young, we call them veligers. They float within the water column for about 2 weeks, And so by draining the water, we are draining any potential zebra mussel veligers, which we can't see, also out of our boats and equipment.
Mm-hmm. But do they cling? I mean, even when the boat is a little bit dry, does that kill them automatically, or are we just trying to stem the tide here a little bit?
Well, adult zebra mussels can also latch on to the outside of boats and motors. And so that's the part of removing everything that's attached to your boat, and then the draining of the water gets rid of veligers. And yeah, this is just like we're trying to prevent the spread of emerald ash borers and gypsy moss that people spread around. It's the same with these. They can easily be spread from one water body to another if we don't.
So talk about the damage they do, the zebra mussels and the plants you mentioned.
Right. Zebra mussels have threads on them called Bissell threads that they use to attach to hard structures. Hard structures can be everything from your boat to water intake pipes. So facilities that get their water for their communities from an infested water body, or hydropower facilities, they spend up to millions of dollars a year because their pipes get clogged up and they have to remove the zebra mussels from them. But they also attach to our native mussels. And so by doing that, they prevent them from being able to filter water to get food and oxygen and so kill them. So it has impacts both on our human side and also on our natural resource side.
And I understand you're fearing that zebra mussels have been found in the Okoboji area, the Great Lakes of Iowa?
Correct. We've had zebra mussels in the Mississippi River since the late 90s, and we've had them in Clear Lake since 2005. Now, last fall, we found four individuals in East Okoboji and Upper Gar Lake. And this summer, through testing, we have found veligers as well. We have a lot more monitoring to do, but we do believe that there is a reproducing population in the Spirit Lake Okoboji chain of lakes as well.
Mm-hmm. What do we do if we are lakeside and we find a zebra mussel? Can we do something about it as individuals, like we do with invasive plants when we're taking a hike?
Certainly, if you are in a water body that we don't know has zebra mussels, definitely give the Department of Natural Resources or your local fisheries biologist or someone a call so that we can verify whether or not it truly is a zebra mussel or not. And, once it's removed out of the water, you keep it out of the water, it's going to dry up, it's going to die.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the plants. What damage do the plants, the invasive plants, do in the water?
The plants are one of those things that just really take over, and so our native plants can't grow as well. And having a diversity of plants, that's when we get the diversity of insects that our fish need, and that are all of just the real good functioning of a lake. And so when we have one plant that comes in and starts taking over, then we see reduced diversity in our insects and in our fish. And it also hinders, it's really hard to get boats and motors and swimmers through lots and lots of thick vegetation.
Asian carp. We haven't talked about Asian carp. What kind of threat do they pose? They've been around, haven't they?
Asian carp, yes, unfortunately, have been in the Mississippi and Missouri River, and they're making their way up into our interior tributaries. I think most people relate to them because they've seen YouTube videos or things, videos on TV of the silver carp jumping out of the water and,
right,
jumping into boats and potentially slapping people in the face.
Mm-hmm. But what do they do? What harm do they do? They crowd out other species as well?
Right, right. The harm to our natural resources is that, again, they reproduce, so there just gets to be really, really large populations of them. And they filter food. They don't eat other fish, but they get all of their food by filtering it out of the water. And so they're just removing the bottom level of the food chain that all of our small fish and other filter feeders need.
Right. And if you want something entertaining, as you mentioned, and to learn a little bit more about these carp, just do a video search, maybe a YouTube search for Asian carp jumping or something. You will find amazing videos. Have you ever experienced something like that where there are tens or maybe even hundreds of them jumping out of the water as they're triggered by the boat going by, huh?
Right. It's the vibrations. We think that they're trying to escape. They feel the vibrations and think that something's going to come and attack them. And so they jump out of the water. And I have, I've been on the Illinois River where a lot of those videos are shot, where there's the hundreds of them jumping out of the water. But even below the Red Rock Dam, where we have a lot of silver carp, we'll have tens, if not 100 of them in the air at a time.
Now, there's been an electric barrier that was at quite high cost put into place. Where is this at to prevent the Asian carp from spreading?
Right. That's below Lower Gar Lake, which is the lowermost lake in the chain of the Spirit Lake Okoboji Lakes. And the flooding of 2011 allowed Asian carp to get past two large barriers on the Little Sioux River and get up into the lakes. And so they've now put a barrier in place to prevent any additional carp from getting up in there.
So that $1 million, as I understand, electric barrier installed was all for naught?
Oh, certainly not. I mean, the fish that are there now, there's not a lot of them. In fact, we've never seen a silver carp jumping out of the water. And we don't think that they will reproduce in lakes. They need flowing water in order for their eggs to survive. So the fish that are there, that are left there, they're trapped. They're not going to reproduce. And so we're preventing any more from getting up into the system and just causing the problems of competing with our fish and potentially recreation, but also just the continuous pressure of new fish moving into the system.
How do you keep track of all these invasive species, Kim?
Well, I have...
What are the tools you have there?
Right. Well, we rely a lot... We as the DNR do a lot of our own surveys, but we really rely on the public as well. If they see something different or unusual, to give us a call, and then we can go check it out and say yes or no. Oh, it is a zebra mussel, or oh, yeah, this is a new location for Asian carp. That's how we had two new reports of big head and silver on the Cedar River this year, and they were by fishermen.
Mm-hmm. So give us some contact information, Kim, and then we'll go to Robin as well in case you have either insects or water infestations of non-native species. Kim, if you do see something strange, different, popping up in, I suppose, your yard or on your property, right?
Correct, yeah. It's popping up anywhere. In the water, I deal with aquatics, but you know, if you see something unusual anywhere, certainly, yep. I'm located out of the Boone Research Station, and my number there is 515-432-2823. I welcome those calls because hopefully I can tell people that, no, it's not an invasive species. But if you go to www.iowadnr.gov, you will find links to the Aquatic Invasive Species page, as well as some of our other insect and terrestrial.
Robin Prusner, when we talk about possible emerald ash borer in your yard, or you suspect something may be wrong there with some insects, how can you find out more? Do you turn to your local local store that deals in plants and trees, or do we go to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship?
You can definitely come to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. You can call my office direct, 515-725-1470. We also have a website, iowatreepests.com, is another way to help you maybe fight your way through what are you seeing. And I can't neglect and offer a word about the Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. No matter your issue, insects or diseases, or if you have any question at all, that is a fabulous resource. You can find them online, or their phone number is 515-294-0581.
Okay, Robin Prusner, state entomologist at the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
And Kim Bogenschutz is the DNR's Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator. Thanks to you as well, Kim.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And when we come back, Tuesday night, a pitcher on Cuba's national baseball team defected after the team arrived in Des Moines for an exhibition game. We'll find out more about that. And also, one of the wettest springs on record. Now, the possibility of a flash drought? What's going on? We'll find out when River to River continues. Hey, thanks for joining us. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. You probably heard the news earlier this week that President Obama recognized two Iowans, Floyd Hammer and Kathy Hamilton, this couple from Union, Iowa, in a White House ceremony. They are founders of Outreach, a nonprofit organization that's delivered millions, hundreds of millions of free meals to children suffering from hunger around the world. They were honored earlier in the White House this week by President Obama, and they'll be on this program tomorrow. We'll talk with them and hear about this outreach program that they've founded. Coming up in just a moment, after one of the wettest springs on record, We'll find out how it is possible that a flash drought is a possibility. Harry Hilliker to join us in just a few minutes. But also in the news Tuesday night, a pitcher on Cuba's national team defected after the team arrived in Des Moines for an exhibition game against the United States. Let's talk a little bit about that with Bryce Miller. He's a Des Moines Register sports columnist joining us by phone. Bryce, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Tell us, who is this Cuban?
Well, we know some basics, but that's almost all we know about him. His name's Misael Severio. I may be pronouncing one or both sides of that name, but he's a 24-year-old pitcher, and as you mentioned, he's with the Cuban national team, and they came to Des Moines to play the first of five games. They'll play a couple in Omaha and two more in North Carolina. It's kind of a friendship exhibition tour. So the Cuban team arrived on U.S. soil Tuesday in a story we ran today in the Des Moines Register, and it's on our website, DesMoinesRegister.com. We confirmed they got to Chicago on Tuesday and then drove to Des Moines. And then late Tuesday night, he left the hotel and has made it clear that he hopes to ask for asylum and defect and play in the major leagues.
Mm-hmm. So he just he waited until he got to Des Moines, I believe, at the Sheraton Hotel, and very late on Tuesday night just walked off and contacted someone.
Yeah, technically in West Des Moines, all we know is there's a sister paper of the Miami Herald, a Spanish-language newspaper that must have had a relationship with the player Severio, and they talked to him, and he said he used the help of friends, must be American friends that he had of Cuban descent or, you know, something along those lines, and they helped him leave the hotel, which is technically in West Des Moines, but yeah, the Sheraton, and and the team has now removed him from their roster. But on the initial roster when they arrived yesterday, he was listed as one of the 24 players to play for Team Cuba.
I wonder if we know any information. You say he landed in Chicago, why he would wait until Iowa to defect?
You know, that's something I'm not sure we know now or we'll know anytime soon. But I talked to some people with U.S. Customs, Immigration, Border Control Services. One of the agents told me that in all the years they've done it, he can only think of two times that a Cuban's walked off a plane, walked up to a U.S. Customs agent and say, I'm requesting asylum. So it generally doesn't happen at port of entry. I think they look for opportunities in these situations where, you know, a kind of a quiet hotel in West Des Moines was a place where there was an opportunity to make a move and try to become a Major League Baseball player.
This Cuban player, as far as we know, simply wanting to pursue his dream of playing Major League Baseball here in the U.S.
Correct. And, you know, one of the websites that explains, you know, Cuban baseball said he had a 1.90 ERA, and we don't know a lot more about him in terms of his potential.
Tell us, is that good or bad?
That's good. okay. That's very good. Earned run average, you know, the amount of runs over any given nine innings statistically that you would allow and anything under two is exceptional, and especially in a place like Cuba where, you know, arguably it's the best international baseball in the world. So he's facing some of the greatest hitters in the game. And it would make you think that he has that potential. Two of the biggest stories in the country this week related to baseball in the All-Star break in Major League Baseball were two Cuban defectors. Yanis Cespedes won the Home Run Derby on Monday night. He defected and signed a $36 million contract with Oakland. Yasiel Puig, the star from the Los Angeles Dodgers, there was a question about whether he should play in the All-Star game despite only being in the big leagues for 5 weeks. He signed a deal for $42 million. So for the people with the highest potential to really make the major leagues, these are millions and millions and millions of dollars at stake.
Were you at the exhibition game that was played in Des Moines?
Actually, it's played tonight.
It will be played tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they got in town, and both teams had workouts yesterday, and that's when we found out that you know, we were able to discover one of the players had left the team. So they'll play tonight at Principal Park. It's home of the Iowa Cubs downtown.
I wonder if you can – do we anticipate a different tone in the stadium in light of the defection, anything different than the baseball game that was originally planned?
I'm not really sure. I know that there was a press conference yesterday, and some of the Cuban delegation was there, their manager, one of their team leaders, and – they joked, and I wondered at the time, knowing now what I wish I'd known then, that they knew about the defection at that point, and maybe they were just trying to get through that public moment and not discuss it and putting.
So they really didn't say anything about it.
They didn't say anything about it, and then I found out personally just shortly after that press conference, and turned around and tried to talked to the Cubans in the clubhouse, and they declined comment. But it's so from their perspective, I don't know if this feels oddly normal that this happens from time to time, or if this does affect how they approach a game tonight. On the U.S. end, nothing changes, but on the Cuban end, you know, I would assume that would rattle you a bit to have top players leave.
Yeah, Des Moines Register sports columnist Bryce Miller, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now joining us, Amy Erica Smith, assistant professor of political science at the Iowa State University. Hi, Professor Smith.
Hi, Ben. Nice to see you.
Nice to meet you, Amy. There we go. What is your reaction to this defection of the Cuban player?
Well, as the Des Moines Register columnist said, there is something that's somewhat oddly normal about it. This is you can see from the Cuban. From the perspective of an average Cuban baseball player or an extraordinary Cuban baseball player, why you would want to do this. I mean, you're a hot shot in a pretty small place, a big fish in a small pond, and you see that, you know, if you get to a big pond, you might have a chance to make it really big. So the incentives for Cuban, particularly Cuban star athletes, to defect to a place like the U.S. are really pretty high. So it is kind of oddly normal. I think this is seen as something that does happen in the course of Cuban sports, and Cubans are accustomed to expecting that something like this might happen in the course. So one Cuban baseball player defecting isn't really an extraordinary piece of news, especially given the incentives for this guy to defect in terms of potential to make it big in the U.S. are really so high. Of course, it's a risk for him, but you know, a lot of young 24-year-old guys who think they're doing really well might see the reason to defect. So,
right. So this is an economic defection. We're not seeing anything ideological here, right?
Well, there's no indication that it's ideological. He might not like the Cuban government as well, but the statements that he has made are about it's too bad that you have to leave your home country. I miss my home, but I'd really like to make it big in the big leagues here. So it sounds like an economic defection largely. What makes where politics gets involved, of course, is that it is our immigration policy towards Cubans, which is that if you were, say, from the Dominican Republic and came to the U.S. to play baseball for a baseball game, you couldn't just leave your hotel and walk up to an officer of the FBI or Customs and Border Protection and say, hey, I want to live in your country permanently.
You wouldn't be a defector, would you? What would you be?
You wouldn't be a defector. You'd just be an immigrant.
Right.
And you'd have to apply for an immigration status, right? So if you're from the Dominican Republic, you don't get automatic entry into the U.S. if you're a baseball player who wants to come to the U.S. But if you're a Cuban baseball player who wants to come to the U.S. and make it big, you can just walk out of your hotel and say, hey, I want to live in the U.S., and a U.S. official will take you seriously and give you basically a green light to stay in the U.S.
I wonder, Amy, if there are any other countries besides Cuba that you would come from to the United States and be called a defector, or is Cuba the only one?
Well, so defector is a particular term that's used for somebody who comes from a country that's in hostile relations with the U.S. So you could be a defector from North Korea, for instance.
Sure.
So there are a limited number of countries at this point that the U.S. has hostile enough relations with that one has to be a defector to leave.
You said oddly normal from the Cuban perspective, but when we wake up and hear this news happening in Des Moines, of all places, it sounds like the relic of the Cold War happening in 2013, doesn't it, right?
Yeah, it does sound like a relic of the Cold War, except that for a Cuban to immigrate to the U.S., this is one of the major ways it happens, is just to, you know, if you manage to make it to the U.S., you get to walk up to a Customs and Border Protection agent and say, I feel that I'm being persecuted in Cuba. Can you let me stay in your country? And they'll usually say yes.
Do you know anything about the process of how this defector, this baseball player, will be treated, processed? What is our interest in, what do we want to determine about defectors when they come here?
When they come here, so you'll be put through an interview. I think CBP, Customs and Border Protection, has 48 hours to process him. So they will ask him, are you a member of the Communist Party? Have you been a member of the communist youth? Are you a member of the military? And assuming he says no to those three items, oh, they'll ask him, are you a criminal? Do you have a criminal record? Assuming he says no to those questions, they will usually grant him immediate asylum seeker status. And under special laws for especially for Cubans, which is asylum seeker status as a Cuban asylum seeker, he will be able to receive human service or services from the government, such as from human services programs, food stamps, those kinds of things. He would be able to receive it. Not that he's looking for food stamps, but he would be able to if he needed it. He'd be able to receive social services, and he would be able to look for work. Within a year of arriving in the U.S., he then would be able to apply for his green card for permanent residency.
Right. He may be applying for the major leagues based on what Bryce Miller of the Des Moines Register said. He may be major league material, need much government assistance. Cuba can't really.
Yeah, well, he's probably not going to need government assistance. But if he, under special policies for Cubans, if he needed them, he could apply for them.
Right. And there's a huge Cuban community here in the U.S., very sympathetic to defectors that would. I can only have – they will have open arms for him, right?
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
Cuba can't Cuba can't really prevent anything from this happening in the future, can they? And as long as they have these exhibition games, right?
Well, no. So it's a relatively common occurrence for Cuban players to walk off to walk off their team and defect. It happens on a reasonably regular basis, which is partially, I think, why it's oddly normal from the Cuban side. It's I think it's recognized as possible. One thing that can possibly happen when the Cuban teams travel, so one thing the Cuban government could do would be to stop having the friendly games. Actually, this is for the friendly games were stopped between 1996 and 2012. There was a 16-year hiatus in friendly games between the U.S. and Cuba. They were not stopped really because of defections, but more because of other policy problems between the U.S. and Cuba. Relations were very, very hostile between the U.S. and Cuba, particularly in 1996 when the game stopped, and then it just took a very long time to get them resumed again. But, so the one thing the Cuban government could do is stop traveling abroad, which it has done before. I don't think they're going to stop it based on one defection, but if, say, 10 players defected, maybe they would think about stopping it.
Amy Erica Smith, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, thank you for your insights, your views on this story.
All right. Thank you, Ben.
And finally this hour, let's talk about the fact that we have had one of the wettest springs on record, but with little current rainfall, a flash drought. Yes, a flash drought is a possibility. Joining us to talk about that very briefly, Harry Hilliker, our state climatologist, also Terry Basul, the Iowa State University Extension field agronomist in northeast Iowa. Hi, Harry. Hi, Terry.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Harry, let's take you first. What is a flash drought?
Basically, kind of just a very rapidly developing drought. Usually you think of drought being kind of a slow thing that just comes on day after day, week after week, month after month. But this is the case where things have been very wet, and all of a sudden rain kind of got switched off and went to the opposite extreme very quickly.
Have I been not hearing it, or is this a new term?
It's a relatively new term. I can't recall just when I first heard that, but say been the last 10 or 15 years, it's gotten to be somewhat common in use, but term.
We're concerned about a flash drought, the possibility of it, but it hasn't happened yet in any part of the state?
Well, there's no strict definition of it, so it'd be hard to say, yeah, this is it, or no, it's not quite yet. But I guess the good examples of it in the past, 1983 would have been maybe one of the more obvious ones where you had a very cool, wet spring, and then about 4th of July, it's just like we just flipped a switch and went to very hot and dry very quickly. Mm-hmm. And not just a little on the hot and dry side, but extremely hot and dry. And it really did a number on crop production. And very, very much a flash drought in that it didn't last very long. It was basically about 6 weeks, 6 or 7 weeks long. And then the rain and cool weather returned. And so you look at the annual records for 83, you say, oh, not much happened that year. Okay. It's a pretty wet year, but time was everything.
I want to have Terry tell us about the effects on ag, but tell us, Harry, which parts of the state are affected most?
Yeah, right now, on the bigger picture, about the southwest, two-thirds of Iowa has been quite dry here for about the last 2 or 3 weeks now, certainly all of July. And going a little bit further back in time, say Memorial Day weekend, which is kind of the end of the really wet pattern statewide anyway, south central Iowa, Indianola, Warren County probably being the worst off area as far as lack of recent rainfall.
Mm-hmm. Terry Basul, tell us, what are the effects we're seeing in crops at this point?
Right now it's looking like we're getting a little bit of dry weather coming our way. So we're actually starting to see, you know, the top part of the soil profile starting to dry out. And you can tell some of the lighter soils in the area as you're driving. The corn's starting to respond similarly to what we kind of saw last year. Not as severe, but corn's starting to roll its leaves a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We could actually use, you don't want to say it too loud, but we could actually use a nice, you know, 3/4 of an inch to 1 inch of rain that come down nice and slow and get everything back up and going again.
Harry, what does it look like? Are we going to get that nice, slow rain, 2 or 3 inches?
Well, this time of year, you tend to get all kind of in a hurry and sort of over a short period of time. Yeah, lots of chances coming up, a small chance tomorrow when a cool front brings us some relief from the temperatures, the higher temperatures we've had, but not really widespread rain expected at that time.
Okay, well,
maybe towards the end of the weekend and next week, we look to have several opportunities. A little hard to say how good they're going to be, but hopefully between several different impulses coming through, one of them will give us some pretty good rain.
Yeah, we got some hopefullys going different directions than this because we've got Ragbri next week, and the thousands of riders on Ragbri don't necessarily want rain. They would like that cool weather that you got for us, Harry, though.
Yeah.
And that's what it's forecast. Highs in the 80s next week, right?
Yeah, basically close to normal, mid to upper 80s for the most part. Normal high for central Iowa is about 86 degrees or so for this time of the year. So very close to that, maybe a degree or two higher.
Wow, compare that with last year. Ragbri riders were going through days that were 100 or even over, weren't they?
Yeah, pretty miserable. And
brutal.
Even though the last few days have been pretty warm here, this July so far is running about 5 degrees cooler than last July. In fact, every month this year has been running cooler than the same month did a year ago, so it's been quite a contrast there. And the highest official temperature we've had in the state this summer, 96 degrees, which was actually yesterday afternoon in a few places, which isn't bad for a July extreme. We might get a little higher today because it's a little bit drier air that heats a little quicker, but for a July temperature extreme, that's, you know, relatively mild, but certainly we'd rather not have those kind of temperatures at all.
Okay, well, thank you very much for telling us a little bit about the effects of the weather and the forecast for the future. Harry Hilliker, state climatologist, and Terry Boswell, the Iowa State University Extension field agronomist in northeast Iowa. We appreciate it. This morning, Governor Terry Branstad called a news conference to discuss the firing of a veteran criminal investigator, Larry Hedlund. Now, the special agent in charge at the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation was fired yesterday, if you caught that on our news. After an internal investigation, Agent Hedlund alleges the investigation was launched after he filed a complaint about the governor's SUV speeding on Highway 20. The SUV, driven by an Iowa State trooper, was clocked at 84 miles per hour. Hedlund has vowed to file suit for wrongful termination. Joining us now to tell us a little bit about what happened at this morning's news conference, Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters. Hi, Clay.
Hey, Ben.
Tell us quickly before we have to say goodbye, what did the governor say about it at this news conference?
Well, he was briefed this morning. He says he reviewed the case and finally got the full story. Now he's saying that the public should know, too, in light of what he's calling false accusations made in retaliation by Mr. Hedlund. So he's asked the Attorney General's office to ask Hedlund's attorney to consider releasing the full 500-page report. He says there's no correlation between why he was fired and the speeding false accusation, as the governor says. And he says the problems involving Hedlund were filed long before this incident.
Okay. So any open questions that you're looking at in particular?
Well, no, he was pretty tight-lipped. He had the governor had his staffers kind of cutting him off, you know, saying he can't really go into detail much about the case, but he did stress several times that there was no involvement by his office in this investigation whatsoever.
Okay, and we'll imagine hear a report either from you or from one of the others at Iowa Public Radio News about this during All Things Considered later this afternoon. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up tomorrow on this program, this week, President Obama recognized Floyd Hammer and Kathy Hamilton of Union, Iowa, in a White House ceremony. Floyd and Kathy on this program tomorrow. Also, Iowa author John T. Price on our program, who hopefully will join us for Friday's show. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, help from Jason Burns in Des Moines. Thanks to Rick Fredrickson. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.